Good evening, this is our second session in the course on White House communications that is I'd say a two-state process, except we're stateless here, Washington DC to Towson University in Towson, Maryland. And the idea of this course is to give people an idea of what the relationship is between the White House and the press from the viewpoint of those who are part of the relationship. We're going to have White House officials here. Dan Bartlett is going to come, and Scott McClellan and Mike McCurry will be guests in 3 different weeks. And then we have last week we had William Seal, White House historian, who provided the setting for us of the White House as a building and the ways in which it had been used to publicize the presidents and their programs. Tonight we have two pioneers. Frances Lewin and Helen Thomas are two reporters who have been important in Washington for the work they have done, and also for the path that they blazed for women. I remember Helen when I first met you in 1975 when I came into the White House working on portraying the president when Mike and I came in. And Helen welcomed every woman who came in as a reporter or me as a scholar, and made sure that that we were helped. And because women at that time and way before had not been, and Fran and Helen had made sure that they got access to the corridors of power. Well, you did, Helen. I mean, look at all the battles the two of you waged.
We chained ourselves to the White House fence and to jail. Not quite.
Well, you
were real pioneers.
Well, you certainly you took on the Correspondents Association, the National Press Club, the Gridiron. It was a pretty good group between the two.
It was
going
to be the next fight, but they capitulated.
They came first. Huh? They worked for competing wire services. They've been friends, but worked for competing wire services. Helen worked for United Press International, and until recently, what year was it? Is it when you went to Hearst? Is it 99? When you went to Hearst newspapers?
2000.
And Fran worked for Associated Press and went to CNN in 1981. You were there at the beginning.
And in the first year.
She created CNN. In the good old days.
In the good old, good place for women. So a good place to begin is what was reporting from the White House like when you came to Washington? Even though when you started, you were not White House correspondents, but what was the atmosphere? What was the atmosphere in Washington of reporters and their relationships with officials? And what about at the White House? Helen, why don't you start? When you came to Washington.
When I came to Washington, it was World War II. I had never seen our country more unified. Everyone was in it together, except everyone believed in the war and so forth. And the whole town was rallied in one spirit, and they had moved from the Great Depression. So great people had come to this country, to this town, from all over the country. Social workers, teachers, healthcare, everyone, all wanting to pitch in and bring the country back. And then we went into World War II. But I think we never had any sense of dissent, as we later saw in Vietnam. As for the press, there was a very small group of men, mostly men, but some women who did come to press conferences. And of all things, Franklin D. Roosevelt held 2 news conferences a week in the Oval Office. And of course, he was in total command, and you couldn't quote him directly. And if he didn't like the question, he'd tell you to go stand in the corner or put a dunce cap on. So it was, you were kind of taking a chance to ask a question that was a little off the parameters. But it was a town that I think all of you would have liked it then. It was not divisive, and everyone was pulling together. and had a real sense of unity.
Uh-huh. And you have to talk about Eleanor Roosevelt, who was responsible really for getting a lot of women journalists their first jobs, because she held press conferences closed to men, and only women could cover her. So every organization had to hire a woman reporter to cover Mrs. Roosevelt.
She made news.
Yes, she did. And that was a breakthrough for a lot of women, who the organizations couldn't cover Mrs. Roosevelt without a woman. So that led the way, in a sense, to...
The whole ruse was to get these people to hire women reporting.
Uh-huh. What was reporting on the First Lady like? What sort of subjects? Say, compare Eleanor Roosevelt and Bess Truman and Mamie Eisenhower.
Well,
because you all covered, I guess between you two, you covered.
Well, really, I didn't start covering until Mamie Eisenhower, but we all knew about Mrs. Roosevelt, and she traveled all over and took women with her. Bess Furman, who worked for the Associated Press and then for the New York Times, wrote books about her travels, and she made news everywhere. And so that was a big boost for women in that direction, I guess. Bess Truman did not do very much. I mean, she stayed out of that kind of role. Mm-hmm. So,
and Roosevelt was really a controversial person. Of course, she was so dynamic, and she was butting in everywhere as a real do-gooder, and she was slammed all over the place, and there was a cartoon showing her going down the coal mine. And one miner saying to the other, "Here comes Eleanor." You can also see her in the crossfire on battlefields and so forth. She walked in where angels fear to tread. She also took a look where you live now, at Georgetown. And it was all black by that time. And she said, "Isn't this lovely? Isn't it quaint?" And the whites started moving in and buying up the property. She transformed it, maybe for the better, maybe. I'm not sure.
I was had a later incident with her. I was trying to get copies of, see if there were any transcripts of the press conferences that she had to get an idea of what was going on. And nobody seemed to have them anywhere. So one day I ran into Mrs. Roosevelt and I said to her, "Do you know, does anybody have any transcripts of your press conference?" She said, "Now, who would want that?"
It's my day.
Yeah.
No, it was a different atmosphere. But of course, I mean, the whole question of journalism, press corps, and so forth has just grown monumentally.
Mm-hmm. When was the first time you walked into the west wing of the White House, into the press room there? And what was it like? We saw
inauguration day, January 20, 1961. I moved in with Kennedy, and I never left. It was one room, what is now would be the National Security Affairs Office. It was,
When you go in the West Wing,
right.
The
newspapers all around.
Right to the right.
Well, you have to say something else. It was very different, because when you walked in, there was an entrance lobby with a huge table that had come from some former president and a couple of couches around. That was the entrance to the president's office. So guests came right past there, and press could sit out on a couch and watch who's coming in and out of the president's office. Then to the side, we had our press room, which was maybe half this size, just about that big. Mm-hmm. Everybody had a little.
It looked like a men's club with leather furniture, spittoons, and places to sleep.
And we had a little telephone. We had actual telephone booths to where we went in to phone in our stories.
Were the phone booths in the press room itself?
Yeah.
How many people would be there on a normal day? How many people would be sitting around the couches and following the president back to
the House? It depends on when the briefing. Maybe I would say 15 or 20. Mm-hmm.
Not a lot.
So, and how many women?
Us.
Full time. We were there all the time. We were the Gold Dust Twins. Women would come for the briefings and so forth, but we were the wirers, and we stayed there 8 days a week.
Yeah. What were the rhythms of the day at the White House then? Today, for example, let's see, not this very day, but on an ordinary day, the press secretary has an open meeting in the morning, the gaggle. He has a briefing that's televised in the afternoon, say at 12:30 or so, and then there are the other briefings that are coordinated with it from state and defense. And the president is going to appear usually in a speech at least once during that day, maybe twice, in a fundraiser at night. What were the rhythms at that time of the White House? What did the president do? When you were covering him, how many things would you expect the president to be doing during a day?
Many things. I mean, I thought that the Kennedy era was a golden era. It was greatly inspired. We could walk side by side with him. When he came out, there was no gaggle of Secret Service protecting him. We had incredible access. Mm-hmm. And he would make many appearances a day. The news was not that programmed into one appearance a day, which later on they wanted the president to only show up once a day and so forth. It was very much more freewheeling. Kennedy would come through the reception room where we'd be hanging out. We'd see his visitors to the door. We would throw questions at him. It was very different in the sense of access.
And the press secretary had a little office where everybody could walk in or out. There was free access. And he would have just a press session with everybody standing around his desk and just shooting questions at him. There was no television and nothing like that. Mm-hmm. So it was very much more informal.
And then we were
a lot of access.
Palm Beach, usually in the wintertime, then Pierre was ordered not to wear shorts anymore.
Was that television?
Yeah, by that time they got
it. We used to travel a lot because he went down to their place at both at Hyannisport in the summertime and Florida in the wintertime. So we had a lot of traveling press operations, which was interesting. And we all moved from one place to the other and just lived there when they were there for their periods of time.
Both of you followed Mrs. Kennedy and
tried to.
And reported her as
she
well.
Hated us.
Like,
she hated us.
Well, I traveled with her in the Mediterranean, where a small group of press hired a 54-foot ocean-going yacht to follow this big yacht that she was loaned by one of the Greek magnates there, and we had to follow her from island to island. And the very first night out, there was a big electrical storm, and our guy said, "I'm really sorry, we're going to have to pull into a port. We can't ride this storm out." So he said, "Oh boy, we're lost. We're out of this." And so we pulled into this place, and the next morning, the sun was shining brightly, and the greatest sight was her yacht parked next to us.
Tell them about India.
Oh, well. The worst part of all of this was that Jackie never said anything. And we traveled all through the Greek islands, and what we did was a travelogue. And we'd listen in. They would report back to what she was doing on ship-to-shore radio. So we tuned in to the radio. We got this stuff so we could report it. Well, they found out what we were doing, so then they would go into French, Italian. Well, we had guys who spoke these languages, and we'd say, "Hey, Joe, it's French." So we got in on all the stuff. But it was mostly a travelogue and battles, too. She went skiing one day off a beach, and they had the Greek Navy chase everybody off the beach. And so our photographers got arrested, and we went there to get him out of jail. And they said to the captain of port, "What does your queen do when she wants to go skiing?" He says, "She goes to a private place." Jackie was going to ski, and this place opened to everybody, just get everybody out of there. So we had a lot of fun with that.
India.
Well,
did both of you go to India?
No. I went to India. She went to India and Pakistan, and the whole time she never said anything. And the biggest thing we got was Jackie made an amnesty to get a crowd. And and so we were once again, we're writing travelogues, where she is, what she was wearing was the big thing. we knew we were going to have trouble, so we asked the press secretary before we went, could you please tell us who the designers are, what the clothes are like, because we always get the colors wrong and everything wrong, so we would like to be really right on this. So mistakenly, he gave us all this information in advance. So therefore, most of what we wrote was about what Jackie was wearing. And they were very upset about that. I remember a colleague of mine was very impressed because we were going to go to the Khyber Pass, and that was so dramatic. He always wanted to go there. So we went to the Khyber Pass, and the two big stories were, one, Jackie wore wraparound sunglasses, which were the newest thing. And the other was one of the cameramen put one foot over the border into Afghanistan, and they were going to grab him and take him away. Oh, then there was, he's giving me all these hints. Jackie was going to come in India. They decorate the elephants magnificently. They paint them with chalk and all this, and they look wonderful. And there was going to be this big parade of elephants in a courtyard for her. So we got there early, and some of the guys said, would you like to ride on an elephant? So we said, sure. So we got up on the elephants, and they're parading around. All of a sudden, Jackie arrives, and we're up on the elephants. Trying to get down, I'm going to cover Jackie. So Theo Wilson.
Never fear, she would say nothing.
New York Daily News was there. She said, don't worry, Jackie never says anything. So yeah, that was true. So we were saved, but there wasn't.
No, she did not like us at all. We were called the Harpies. And she...
Tell them about what you did in Palm Beach, the Secret Service.
Oh, we were on the steps of the church when she was going in, and she alerted the Secret Service. Two Spanish-looking women. You ought to arrest them.
What did the president think about your reporting? Did he complain? as she did?
They were very ambivalent. They loved the photographs of the children. But at the same time, they wanted to put up a big facade that they hated the coverage of their children. Uh-huh. But every time there was a photograph, they asked for 10 copies.
Because yeah. I see here that Kennedy signed a picture to you, and it says, with admiration and in warm regards.
Well, tell them the story about the hospital when John Jr. was born.
What?
When you were outside.
I had, when John was born, we all got phone calls at 11:30 at night, and everybody rushed to Georgetown Hospital, every reporter in town probably, and I'm putting up my hair and pulling it down and buttoning up and trying to grab a cab. We got there, and so Fran and I were at the hospital. We practically became nurses. We were there 10 days, and buttonholing Kennedy, who would come twice a day. And we'd think, what will we ask him next? And I remember asking him, do you want your son to grow up to be president? And he said, I just want him to be healthy. Well, one day, on the 10th day, my boss told me to go to the Georgetown House instead of going to the Georgetown Hospital, because Kennedy was going to leave to do the protocol pro forma trip to the White House to meet with the sitting president, who would tell him how to be president and tell him all the secrets. Well, I don't think he did. But anyway, Kennedy came out of his house on N Street, took one look at me and said, you've deserted my child. He had been on duty at the hospital for 10 days.
It's very interesting because we really had sort of a very personal relationship with the president in those days. I mean, you could walk up to him and he would answer a question for you. And they knew us, and they weren't worried about us. We didn't have this overkill Secret Service entourage everywhere we went. And so we were much more able to understand what the president was like in those days. And there wasn't a huge amount of people going. There was always a press pool of just several people, and mostly UP and AP. And so we got a chance to be very able to understand and get close to what was going on.
What kinds of things would you ask him? Would you ask him about a particular policy, that he decision that might be underway?
Sure. Anything.
Yes.
And what?
Was it all on the record?
Okay.
Was it on the record? Would he speak back and off the record?
No.
All on the record?
Yeah.
I once got him out of a a bad situation. They had a news conference, and I was supposed to end the news conference, and he got a question that was very clear. He didn't know the answer. He kept talking, hoping to hit on the answer. And I finally got up and said, "Thank you, Mr. President." He said, "Thank you." And then once a Latin American president, Venezuela, I think, came to the White House, and Fran and I had been protesting, saying that he should not go to the National Press Club where we couldn't go. But the Venezuelan president did plan to go, and Kennedy saw him to the door, and he pointed to me and he said, "There is one of the revolutionaries." And so I said to the president of Venezuela, "Well, we forgive you officially." And Kennedy said, "But not personally."
Well, I have to tell you about that. At this time in the Kennedy period, I think there were about 66 women who were actually accredited to cover the White House and run hundreds of men, and they had an annual White House Correspondents' Dinner in honor of the president. No women allowed, so we were pretty upset about that.
But we could be members of the association, yeah. And the dues were $2 a year. And the only raison d'etre, the only reason to have the association, was to give a dinner in honor of the President of the United States once a year. We were members, and we were not allowed to go to the dinner.
So we started a campaign with Salinger and Kennedy and all of them, and the end result was, after crying and yelling and whatever, we finally, Kennedy just said, "I won't go unless women can go." And that was the end of that, and to this very day, women can go to that. That was one of the easiest breakthroughs, uh-huh. when the President actually understood the problem and helped us out.
Uh-huh. We weren't allowed in the National Press Club till 1971. And that's a long time into the 20th century.
When did you
and
start
a long
lobbying?
Time after suffrage.
Yeah. We started lobbying very, very early. We were relegated to the balcony finally with all the press, the television cameras, and we couldn't ask questions. And one of our friends who was assigned to cover a visiting head of state, all the visiting heads of states held their only press conference at the National Press Club. It got to be a tradition. So if you were assigned to cover him at the major event, you couldn't be on the floor, so you couldn't ask questions. If anything happened, you're on the balcony and you cannot cover it at all. So we were, one of our friends was actually taken off the assignment because she couldn't cover it properly, and a male colleague was sent in. So this was the kind of problem that existed. So we protested and went to the State Department and said that our Women's National Press Club would put on an event open to everyone. We would have a big luncheon if that's what you wanted. And so nothing helped. So we began sending telegrams to every head of state that was coming here. We were in Western Union in the middle of the night sending telegrams saying, "Don't come to this discrimination against women." So our hero was Khrushchev. When he came, we had bombarded them with the same propaganda, and he said, "I won't go unless women can." So they finally allowed women, and just for that time, at 1.3 women to every 10 men was the ratio somebody picked out.
For the first time in history, of 1959, women were allowed to sit on the floor with their male colleagues, who they go toe-to-toe on stories with for the first time in history, and never to go again until 71. I was at the head table because I was head of the Women's National Press Club, and that's when Khrushchev made his famous "We will bury you" speech. Mm-hmm. Well, we buried them instead, but I mean, it was a very historic moment.
Mm-hmm. So we fought this fight bitterly with the State Department, and once I was in an elevator with Dean Rusk, and I was appealing to him to do something about it, because we felt all they had to do was just tell these people, "Don't go there, go to a place that's open to everyone for your press conference." So I appealed to Dean Rusk in the elevator, and he said to me, "Well, you should picket and embarrass them, then maybe that would help." Whereas all he had to do was tell his aides that they should do something, and it would have all worked out. So we would get people who would say they would come to our open to everyone luncheon. We had these big luncheons. And we got Madame New. She was supposed to be at the press club on Friday. We got her on Wednesday to a huge dinner, luncheon with 500 people and scooped the press club on their own. So it was battles like that that you had to go through to just try to open it up.
How did they justify keeping it closed?
They didn't have to. They had total power and control. I mean, discrimination against women was so blatant, but nothing compared to the blacks. The same time the civil rights movement and so forth. I mean, we were discriminated against, but nothing as something as the racial problems.
But one of our worst things was that when Martin Luther King came to town, they had their only press conference explaining what was going to happen at the National Press Club.
Except
no
for the,
women.
Except for the March in Washington?
Yeah. And so we appealed to them to not do that, but they wouldn't have anything to do with it. So we sent out a press release saying, balcony is back in the bus, which got a lot of headlines and caused them considerable embarrassment, but we could never understand why that had happened.
And
you see, that press club was so prestigious that everyone thought that was the place they had to go, or they couldn't have a press conference where everybody would come. That was a basic problem.
And the main thing is that when you have this kind of discrimination and you're able to erase it, the next day people wonder, what was all the shouting about? Why? Why did we, hold out for so long? Same thing happened in the Gridiron Club, the White House Correspondents, National Press Club. Every door we had to break down separately.
In the Gridiron, we picketed in evening clothes for several years. And then finally we decided that, well, we can't do this, we're going to try something else. So we had a counter gridiron big party in Mount Vernon College, and where they were white tie and tails, we were jeans and no tie. And we got all the VIPs in town came to our thing. It was like a carnival. We had events, pin the tail on the male chauvinist pig, and Dan Rather did a dime a dance. Stuff, and we got over 800 people there. We embarrassed them, got a lot of publicity. We did it 2 years in a row, and they capitulated.
Mm-hmm. Finally.
Yeah. So by the 1970s, it took until that time.
Later than the 1970s. Yeah. It's way in the
71 is
In looking at the White House itself and the change in the number of people who come as reporters, what has been gained and what has been lost by the changes in coverage? There are now more people. You have more things that are on the record. The president speaks more on the record now than he did, say, when you first came to the White House.
We used to walk around the South Lawn with LBJ. We called them the Bataan Death Marches but we learned more about what a president was going through. By this time, he was in great trauma on the Vietnam War. He tried to figure out how he could work himself out of it, and still listening to the generals. So he would be pouring out his heart, and usually he would say after he had told us so much, it's all off the record.
Helen and I used to be the only ones there around lunchtime, and the press secretary would come in and say, the president wants to talk to you. We'd sit in the cabinet room with the LBJ while I was pouring out his heart about his problems in Vietnam, all off the record. And in those days, we honored off the record, and it was off the record.
One day, after he had renounced re-election, and he was feeling really sorry for himself, he gave a diplomatic reception. And Liz Carpenter, the press secretary, the first lady, had always warned us to try to be ladies and don't carry those big stenographer's notebooks and try to dress nicely. So we carried little notebooks and we were trying to be very well behaved. Johnson came along at the end of the evening, scooped us up, about five or six newspaper women, took us to the family quarters, where passed out a good drink, and regaled us with all the stories of the presidency and what he thought of this. I finished my little notebook, grabbing onto notebooks, to napkins and matchbooks, and he stood there writing all that. He saw us all writing all of this stuff. And when it was, Mrs. Johnson kept coming into the room trying to break it up, at the end, again, he handed us each a little charm bracelet and said, "Now you know it's all off the record."
But we really got to know Johnson very well. This was another thing. A friend of ours had asked, she worked for the Washington Star, and she was trying to get an interview with the president. So one Saturday, they call her up and say, "The president will give you your interview. Come down to the White House." So she went to the White House, and they were going along, and he finally said, "Are you going to that wedding party that was Cokie Robbins that's getting married?" And so she said, yes, she was going. So he said, "Well, come on along." So they go up there. We were all at that thing. And then finally it's over, and he takes her back in the limousine, and he's going to continue this endless press conference. So finally she said, "Mr. President, you know, it's my daughter's 14th birthday, and I'm planning a party, and I really have to get home." So he whips out a piece of paper. "What's her name?" He writes a note to her. "Sorry I kept your mother so long." He stopped the motorcade, gets her another limousine, and sends her home in the limousine with this note for her daughter.
The AP man and I got into his limousine once. He beckoned to us after he had said he wasn't going to run again, but Bobby announced that he was going to run. And so, of course, the AP man and myself kept saying, "Well, what do you think about Bobby Kennedy deciding to run?" He said, "Do you like these cufflinks?"
I think we ought to tell you a little bit about the difference of how we worked our way into covering the White House full time. When we first went to cover the White House, we were covering the East Side, the First Lady, and we would have to go to these formal parties for visiting heads of state, all dressed in long gowns and gloves up to here, and the men didn't want to cover those events because that was just beneath them, social parties, you know. So we went to cover these events, and we pretty soon figured out that here were all the top officials of the government, and we could get to them and ask them a question. So we began doing that, and we would, whatever the big topic of the day was, we could get to the Secretary of State, sometimes the President himself, and we would get these wonderful scoop stories out of these parties. So then they decided maybe they ought to come to the parties.
Actually, you could. You had total access on a social occasion. You let us roam around, mix and mingle.
When did that stop?
When did that stop? It stopped really with these people. This, I think we had much more access. It stopped really. Hillary hated us to be around. Something about these women. Something about the newspaper.
How did it feel to... to
be shunned
regarded
by a first lady?
To be regarded in the hospital.
I've been shunned by presidents, so what the heck? I tell you, I mean, they have a right to not suffer us gladly, but we have a right to be there. It's our house. Every president I've ever known has said, "This house belongs to you, to the American people." I say, "Oh, great." So when they start pushing me around, I say, "Hey, I thought this house belonged to me." The American people, we pay the taxes. And I always remind the press secretaries that they are public servants. If the president wants a public relations person, he should pay out of his own pocket. But these people are public servants, and they owe the American people the real truth and the information. And they're so secretive now, and they're so robotic and so on spin. It's changed a lot.
Most of the public affairs jobs in the government started with Roosevelt, when they had all these alphabetical new places and nobody knew what they were about. So they hired mostly news people and their role was to help the press get with the government and find out what these agencies were about and find their way into the agencies. And they were paid to do that as a public information job. So what's happened as things have gone along is now these people are paid with government money to spin things and to try to keep you away from the public officials. And it's been a whole turnaround. Its original purpose was to provide information, and they're paid to help the...
We pay them, the taxpayer pays them. They're dealing with public information, and they've been dealing with people's right to know, and they have to be schizophrenic. They have to wear two hats. But this press secretary says that he's an advocate for the president. And I don't think that's absolutely a change of view of what a press secretary should be at the White House.
Do you think that that with all of the organization there is at the White House directing coverage in a particular way and putting out an agenda for the day, does that prevent reporters from covering what is the story?
Well, a lot of times that they send out word to the various people, staffs and so on, don't take any calls from the press. Pass it on to the press secretary or the public affairs person. So you used to be able to call up the national security advisor or other staff members to find out what was going on. Well, now they want to block this all
off. The most closed White House that I've ever covered.
In your book, this is in Dateline White House, you say, on my epitaph, I want only one word, why. In the press, that question is central to our search for truth.
And not enough people are asking why today. We have no follow-ups. We have no understanding. They will issue their edicts and their pronouncements, and nobody says why. Mm-hmm. That is the question if you want any pursuit of the real answers. I still don't know why Bush went into Iraq.
Well, you've had you've questioned him on the point, and Scott McClellan and Ari Fleischer, you've questioned them as well.
But I got no answers.
Marlon Fitzwater, when he was asked how President George H.W. Bush decided when to have a press conference, he said, "Well, you know," he said, "there's a certain pressure that builds up in the press room." He said, "The president would ask me about the pressure out there." And he would say, "What's Helen saying?"
He'd say, "Let's have one."
Helen Fitzwater pushed
once made a speech saying, "The press, they only know 5% of what goes on around here." And I used to repeat that in speeches. I would say, "See, they only tell us 5%. It's a closed corporation here." So he came to me and he said, "But you didn't repeat what the rest of us." Of the sentence was that the other 95% isn't worth knowing. That's not true. You really, there's more secrecy in this administration than I have ever encountered.
One of the things that's different is that the president has given fewer solo press conferences than was once.
You're the expert on that.
It was once the case. What do you all see as the importance of press conferences? What do you get out of a press conference, a solo press conference, where the president's going to be questioned, say, by about 20, usually it's about 20 different reporters, and over a period of, say, about 45
minutes? This is my lecture. A presidential press conference is the only forum in our society where a president can be questioned on a regular basis and held accountable. We are the only transmission belt where he has to really, and it isn't in the Constitution, but it's indispensable in a democracy that a leader should be questioned. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we could have a king, a dictator. He could rule by edict.
And a great deal is shown by the way the president answers a question. I mean, he may turn it aside. He may not even answer it, but then the public can see what exactly he is doing, and that's very revealing, and it's one of the good things about press conferences.
He doesn't have to go to Congress, that he could be subpoenaed, but they're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. But we are after them every day to try to get the answers and to explain. You cannot have a democracy without an informed people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's our mission, is to try to keep people as informed as possible. But when they have total control of the information, and dribble it out, and then some of it's not quite credible, mm-hmm. we're in trouble.
Mm-hmm. What, in the various presidents that you've covered and have gone to press conferences,
what are some of the things that that you think have come out about them through press conferences? What did you learn about the president through press conferences?
Wow, a lot. It's hard to pinpoint, I think. You know, I think everything they say is informative and gives you an idea of what they're thinking and how they comport themselves, mm-hmm. whether a president can answer a question easily, whether he knows a lot about the subject matter, whether he appears to be in charge of things. I mean, it's totally revealing, I think. And as far as news, there's a lot of news comes out of it, too. But I think you get a real feeling about how the president can handle himself.
Mm-hmm. I think it takes a lot of courage when there's a crisis, and especially if it's a personal crisis. Jimmy Carter had to answer questions about his brother that were very, very embarrassing, but he still went to the mat with us. And in the case of Clinton, we didn't hold back on Monica Lewinsky questions, and I don't know how he was able to really stand up to that. But you can always tell, in the case of Kennedy, his press conferences were a joy, and they really evoked this tremendous interest in the country in presidential news conferences because he was so warm and witty and could put us in our place, but it was always in with good nature. Mm-hmm. LBJ hated news conferences. Uh-huh. I mean, he...
The formal ones, yeah. He
would experiment
us walking around the backyard 17 laps.
Status.
taking notes and running around. He actually ran into a lamppost and knocked himself out. He had to go to the hospital.
He would speak in a whisper, so we'd all go back to the press room. What did he say?
You all worked as competitors from the competing wire services. In what way do reporters compete with one another, but also they depend on one another, they help one another in certain kinds of circumstances?
Well, you're standing in the snow for 8 hours waiting for some VIP to come out the door. You're all in it together. I mean, it's a real sharing. If you want to go to the ladies' room or anything else, you share. If you have an exclusive, you don't share.
Well, one of the interesting things that reporters nowadays don't have to worry about, and that is a telephone. I mean, the biggest thing was to try to get a phone to get out the story where you were on the road or wherever you were. Now everybody's got a cell phone. It's perfectly wonderful. But we used to fight for phones as one of the biggest things.
And have quarters in our shoe. Uh-huh. And when they were a quarter.
Dime, I remember.
Dime.
Well, let's go to some questions. Let's start with Towson. I think we'll go back and forth. We'll have a question from Towson, and then we'll have a question here. And we've had a little trouble with the volume there, so I'll repeat the questions.
This question is for Ms. Thomas. I read the transcript of a speech you recently gave to some students at MIT about the George Bush administration. Can you elaborate a little bit on your feelings about the current administration? And
Well, you said it was a speech that she gave at MIT,
right,
about Bush? And what would you like her to elaborate on, her general views?
I don't want to forget it.
And what do you think that students could do that would be beneficial to the country as far as participating?
Participate in the election.
That's right. I think that when Dean really rallied a lot of the young people, that was a very good... We remember that era, too, in the 60s, when people mm-hmm. were revved up on a cause. Mm-hmm. And he said, this is your generation, the 21st century, and you are the leaders. If you let it go and we start in with perpetual war, that's what you've got to stop. This syndrome that one war after another, is that the way you're going to repeat In 20th century, we had 2 world wars, Korea, Vietnam, Gulf War. That's no way to live.
On the Bush administration, you said a little while ago that you thought it was the most closed administration. Can you say how that is so? How does it differ from earlier administrations?
Press secretary comes out with one page, and no matter what you ask, he never is on the word, actually. I mean, no matter what you ask, he just gives you the same answer. Like, it's been trained, very robotic, and so forth. That's not the way to deal with us.
Do you think that occurred in, say, in earlier administrations, like the, say, in the Reagan administration and the Nixon administration? They pretty much had an operation where...
Well, they decided that they would have him on TV every night with one story.
Uh-huh.
And it wouldn't let us cover a lot of things that we knew that were newsworthy, because we would be off the story. So they can control the news in so many ways.
Mm-hmm. How does one go about getting the other story, the story that the stories they may not want you to cover?
You have to have people inside mad at each other.
that's a whole
turf war.
It happens
if they cut it off where they
send everybody through the press secretary when you try to get a call through, then it is very difficult indeed. So the problem is to get to people outside of the White House or outside of the telephone, because they cut off that way.
Thank God for whistleblowers. Thank God for leaks. There's no such thing as a leak. There's only information they don't want you to have.
William Price, who is thought of as the first White House correspondent, although there were two or three of them in the 1890s, he was, in 1902, he was writing about the White House as a beat. And he said, news is rarely distributed at the White House. He said, you usually have to go to other parts of government. They will give you part of the story, but they will only give you their part.
That's still true.
But you have to go elsewhere. And he talked about the need to go up to the Hill and then also to go to agencies. And so in some ways, that remains.
Well, we're all mea culpa on Watergate, that's true. I mean, but at the same time, we're so circumscribed in what we can cover, and the doors are closed and so forth, so it did take a police reporter, a couple mm-hmm. of them, to really get dig to the facts and so forth. But wire services, we were on the body watch. Our main thing was to see if somebody was still alive when they're out in public, meaning mm-hmm. the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm. It is true that the Hill is one of the best places for information, because you have both sides, Democrats, Republicans, independents, and there's always some way, some staffer, some person who really wants to help to get information out, and that is one of the best sources, mm-hmm. and then you can play that back and forth, but that is really a good place to cover.
Uh-huh. And the turf wars in the White House, do they have them in this administration?
If they do, I don't think so. I think everyone's on the same page. I think that you have no devil's advocates. At least in the Vietnam War and Johnson era, you had George Ball, who was saying, no, let's cut this off, stop this war. But in this administration, I don't think any dissent is tolerated.
But you have it between departments. I mean, there are times when you can get something out of a department. There's some differences between them, like between state and defense. But the White House is pretty buttoned up.
Well, I think the State Department and Pentagon, if you really got in between them, you would have some.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the very fact that the Pentagon set up its own intelligence
mm-hmm.
unit raw material going in and being able to twist the facts. I mean, there were no caveats, apparently, enough to... Well, this whole fiasco of weapons of mass destruction, where are the people?
Well, the questions were asked. I mean, you asked the question consistently from the start.
It didn't matter.
but answers definitely were difficult to get. Let's have a question. Let's have a question from here. Yeah. And he's going to be using the microphone. Up, thank you. There it is.
Hi, I just have a question for both of you. I'm an aspiring journalist, so it's really great to see you up here. But my question is, have you both seen a change, or rather a shift in journalism since 9/11? And if so, what is the shift?
Since 9/11?
Mm-hmm.
Then it's a shift in journalism since 9/11.
Was that in the terms, do you think, of the relationship with government?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That there's a different relationship between
we all rolled over and played dead. Everybody was afraid to rock any boats, afraid of being called unpatriotic, un-American. And I think that we looked very, very bad. We should have been asking the important questions, no matter what. But the whole idea of these televised briefings and fear that people would say, why is she jeopardizing our position here? Why is she jeopardizing the troops and so forth? So I think everyone pulled in their horns after 9/11 for too long.
Well, I think it's changing now, though.
Yeah.
Okay, let's have a question from Towson.
So my question is, if this closing of the White House happened maybe gradually, possibly following the technological development and the fact that the general population is more interested in what happened in the White House with greater internet access and seeing cell phones, or did it happen specifically with this administration?
She was asking about the closing of the White House and whether that happened gradually. If it has anything to do with technology, the technology that exists.
Closing and what?
Of the White House that Helen was saying, and me too, that you don't get to see the president as you once did. What are the factors that have brought that about?
Well, the assassination attempts, gradually,
security has
mm-hmm. tightened up. But 9/11 gave them a carte blanche to do anything.
Uh-huh. But are they referring to the tightening up on the news and access?
Access to officials, but also the proactive things too that a White House does. That you have an organization, operation, like the whole communications operation that comes in under Nixon that did not exist before. Yeah. I mean, before that, you had a press office that responded to your inquiries, and that was the whole communications operation. But after the Nixon administration, the Office of Communications really does a lot of planning.
I think a lot of difficulties started with the Nixon administration because of Watergate, and that caused a whole tightening up of information. And I think a lot of it, and the antagonism between press and the officials became obvious then, and I think that was the beginning of the difficulties, and then it's been carried over not for anything of the same reasons, but because there's more intent to close things down.
Mm-hmm. In 1959, the U2 incident occurred, and looking at the post World War II period and some of the antagonism between the White House and the press, that seems to stand out as one of the first times where the White House is giving a story that is not the truth about what the plane was that was shot down over the Soviet Union. They said it was a weather plane and it was a spy plane. And reporters, and going back to the briefings, reporters were very hard on Hagerty about that, about the lie. And it seems it kind of goes from there to Vietnam to Watergate.
Yeah, Watergate was a real
person. Once you lose your credibility, you have finished, really. I saw two presidents go down the drain, Johnson on Vietnam and Nixon on the Watergate scandal, because they had lost their credibility. If the people no longer believe in you, you cannot govern, you cannot convince, and you cannot persuade. You're finished, really. I think this president's on a slippery slope because of the weapons of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
that don't exist.
He says they're still looking. There was a question over here.
That was actually my question.
Oh, okay. In the back.
Hi, this question is for Ms. Moon and Ms. Levine and Ms. Thomas, and I have a follow-up for Ms. Thomas. And that is, Ms. Thomas, in your book, Front Row in the White House, you said Mike McCurry was the gold standard of press secretaries. Who was the opposite? Who did you two like the least? And
and then maybe she can talk about why she thought McCurry was good and why why the opposite is the opposite.
Yeah, and Mrs. Thomas, how did you be how did you become the user person who closed the White House?
He wants to know about McCurry first, that you had said in the Front Row in the White House that he was the gold standard for press secretaries, and why. And then how was it that you closed the press conference?
I think that McCurry saved himself and has saved his credibility, which is the most important thing you've got to have, I think, in this life. Plus being a spokesperson, the impossible job, it is an impossible job. As press secretary at the White House, you speak for the President of the United States. You speak for the United States. You speak for the whole federal government, and you speak for the American people. That's one hat. The other hat is that you have to speak to the press, and therefore to the people, and it's almost an impossible job, but McCurry did it very well, because I think he prized his credibility. Wire services used to cover, we manned the barricades long before the advent of TV, and the whole process of press conference was set up in that era when the wires were predominant. And as a consequence, the senior wire service reporter would close the news conference, and UPI and AP would rotate on the first two questions. So we were very privileged, and we didn't have to scream like banshees to get at a news conference. Those were the good old days.
There were times I was in reading Roosevelt's press conferences. There were times when he went out to sea, when he was, because as a former Navy person, he was always very interested in ships, and he would go out for some time, whether it was fishing or out on a destroyer, and he would take the three press associations at that time. So Merriman Smith went, Bud Cornell, and Robert Nixon. And so there was a tradition of the wire services
having very tight little prominent posted.
Yeah. I always wondered this major story. I think it was Cleveland who had a major operation out on a ship at sea, and no one knew about it at all.
Yeah.
So in those days, even they knew how to control it.
That's right. But it was his secretary, who had been his secretary, Dan Lamont, who was the one who figured out how to do that without the without publicity. Yeah.
Well, I think that people have the right to know almost everything that goes on in government. And most candidates, presidential candidates, will promise an open administration on the campaign trail. We used to try to pin them down. How many press conferences will you have? How often? And so forth. The moment they come into the White House, the Iron Curtain comes down. And all information that I think belongs in the public domain becomes their private preserve. Mm-hmm. How is that?
It's really quite interesting to watch the election campaign now, where everything is open and they post to every candidate anything, you can ask anything anywhere, and it's very interesting to see what happens afterward and try to hold it up to them. They always...
Kerry, I think, has said he would have one.
Everything becomes one top secret. Mm-hmm. They want to put in their thumb and pull out a plum every once in a while.
Okay, let's take a question from Towson.
Helen, you had said that there are no information that they want us to know. You said that you think we should know everything, but are there certain things that you feel that we shouldn't know?
What things shouldn't we know? You say that we should know just about everything.
Oh,
what should we not know?
Hiding the missiles or...
You
dear Bob.
The press is always kept secrets, like when we're going to do an invasion or something, that they take the press along, and the press has not, for, you know, mentioned any of that. I think there are things like that that definitely press has to control.
Once they lie, they've lost the people, I think.
Is that one time reporters would know things.
Better to say no comment than to lie.
That seems to be a hard thing for people to say, or I don't know.
Right.
I interrupted you,
okay, that's fine. Let's have a question from here.
It was just actually a follow-up to that one. In terms of what the public should know as well, do you think everything that we found out about Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, do you think that that was our right to know, or do you think that kind of got in the way of maybe what was more related to the government business?
Monica Lewinsky. Was that too much information?
No. The vice president of the United States. I think that it's a very sad story, and I think that President Clinton did not know 1 second, I didn't say minute, in the White House when he was not demonized by the ultra-right. They never gave him any legitimacy. How he stood it for 8 years, I will never know. They never let up. They had the White House, the Republicans, for 12 years, and they were not going to accept. For a senator to say that the President of the United States should not come to my state without a bodyguard, on it went. He was not my president and so forth. So how he rode out those storms, I think he made a terrible mistake. He was not street smart. I mean, know your enemy. And he should have known that he was being watched and that they would wait for anything. So I'm sure he has many regrets not to have been more aware. But it was a legitimate story, a question.
At one time, we didn't know much or ask much about a president's health. So that, say, Franklin Roosevelt had frequent press conferences, but people did not ask him about his health. And at one particular point, he went away for a month because he'd been so ill. And it was the three same guys. Cornell, Smith, and Nixon were in South Carolina.
There was a gentleman's agreement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for example, they never showed him in his wheelchair, which would never happen today. Mm-hmm. And so that was...
Photographers would never take...
And Kennedy, the same thing. There's a lot of information we didn't know about his health. So do you think that we are better off with more information rather than less?
Absolutely.
About the personal lives?
Yeah. I mean, we have to make decisions. We should know that about candidates going into the White House, too. I think that much more attention should be paid to all these things, like their medical, any information about them is needed, because after all, they're going to run the country, and if they're not capable of physically of doing it, we have to know that.
I say that if you want to run for public office, you should decide at the age of 5 and live accordingly. That's the best advice I could give to anyone. If you become a public servant and a politician, you have to know your life will be an open book. From now on, there's no holds barred. Mainstream press might decide, no, we're not going to deal with that. That's personal, private, and what, so what? Tabloids won't let it go, and then we'll be accused of covering up, not dealing with the story. Mm-hmm. Even though we think it's unfair or trivial, you still have to hop on.
Mm-hmm. Towson?
What do you think, looking, say, 40 years from now, the way we're heading right now, what will democracy look like as a result of this more restricted atmosphere?
He's asking, say, to take 4 years hence, what will the shape of democracy be as a result of the restrictions of information? Do you think that it has an impact on our system?
I think if there's a continuation of the Patriot Act and they even expand it, I think we're going to lose a whole Bill of Rights.
Do you think... do you think that there is a movement against it? That there are areas where people have
have been very opposed to it, segments of the society, and it takes some time for them to coalesce.
Absolutely.
Well, I was thinking of libraries.
I think that people are waking up.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear the applause when the president said the Patriot Act will expire and then what? Everyone hooray! Then all of a sudden, but I am going to ask for. I think people are understanding. They don't want that intrusion in their private life. Breaking into the email, checking.
Watch out for the Freedom of Information Act, too, which is under fire. And I think that's a very important thing because we can't get inside government. And it takes sometimes when press has to file suits to get this, it takes a very, very long time. And that was set up so that you could get the information if you had a legitimate reason right away. And I think that's another thing that has to be watched out for.
First thing after 9/11, Ashcroft sent a memo to all the federal agencies, turned down every FOI request.
He said that the Justice Department would support them in turning them down. Mm-hmm. The Freedom of Information Act is certainly one of the major pieces of legislation that deals with reporting, how you do your jobs from the time that you all first came to Washington. What has the impact been? Have you seen the difference that act made once it was passed
in
1964?
Much so.
Because what it was supposed to do is to instead of the government having to justify why we get the information from the government with the Freedom of Information Act, the government had to justify why they were keeping information from us. What kinds of stories during your careers have come out because of the Freedom of Information Act?
I think there were a lot of them. I can't pinpoint them, but I know Washington Post had very many cases where they went in for things, as Associated Press did. They still are doing this every day, but it's much getting harder and harder. But there's no doubt about
though.
It that there were a lot of information came out in the Watergate, too, through Freedom of Information.
Iran-Contra.
Yeah.
But I do think that they make it so difficult, and they did that. They black out so much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is control of the information, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll take a question from here.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for coming. I have two questions. The first one is addressed to both of you. Out of all the presidents you've covered, who's your favorite and your least favorite and why? And my second question is addressed to Ms. Thomas. And I was wondering if you were honored, humbled, or angry regarding Saturday Night Live's impersonation review.
the best president and your one president you like most covering, and the president you like least covering, and then your response to Saturday Night Live's impersonation of you.
I like covering all presidents. They all hate me, and it's mutual. it was very inspiring to cover JFK, because I really felt that he had his eyes on the stars. He told young people like you to go into public service, to give something back to the country. There was a sense of uplift that you got with Kennedy. I mean, it wasn't all perfect, and he hated us, but nevertheless, we saw where he was going. LBJ was a three-ring circus. I mean, you never knew what the man was going to do next. He was totally paranoid, and they wouldn't even tell his wife where he was going. I went to Texas twice without a toothbrush.
We were in an airplane once when they didn't know where the airplane was going. They changed their mind in the mid-air.
What was the last part of it? Oh, on the Saturday Night Live. Well, I think I could have done a better job.
Have you ever done Saturday Night Live?
Huh?
Have you ever been a guest at Saturday Night Live?
Yeah. In fact, I never watch it, but I've always told about it.
Fran, who are your favorite?
Well, I have to go along with that. I thought Kennedy was a lot of fun to cover and was very interesting. And but I also liked Johnson because I thought we had so much more access to him. You really knew him once and all, as it were, because we've chased him over the Texas
hill country
and he'd pick us up and take us in his limousine to ride somewhere. You could talk to him. I mean, and these things he did with us in the cabinet room. I mean, you really had an insight into what the president was going through and what he was like. I mean, he didn't always like what he did, but he certainly was accessible. Mm-hmm. And I think that was, he was more accessible in some ways than
and
Kennedy
was. Totally interested in the news. He had three tickers
in
the Oval Office.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there's a picture of him where he is looking at the wire copy, but he has it. He's going down on his knees, and he's watching it when it's being typed out.
Coming up,
yeah.
The wonderful story about her colleague Spivak, who was in his telephone booth phoning in a lead to something that just happened, and the press secretary came out and knocked on the door and said, "President says you've got the wrong lead."
We always felt we were wired, you know, that he had heard everything. In fact, they used to write our names after a question. Oh, I know who asked that question. The president, he wanted to know who was asking all the meetings.
He would listen into the little press briefing in the office with Reedy and where we were all around, and he would be listening in, and he would call him on the phone and tell him to do something.
And we would see his face would go white. Because his POTUS was calling. President of the United States.
I think we're at Montalcin. Montalcin next.
You both seem to have a very cordial relationship with President Kennedy. So how is it like to cover Kennedy's assassination?
You all, both of you had a cordial relationship with Kennedy. What was it like to cover his assassination?
Close relationship is not exactly the one. We had a repertorial adversarial. Well, my boss, we had one man in Dallas. Mm-hmm. It was a brilliant reporter, the best that could ever come down the pike. He had covered the White House from FDR on. His name was Merriman Smith. He had been a gun buff. He knew the difference between a backfire and a gunshot. In those days, the motorcades were like five cars, mm-hmm. and the wires were in the third car, UPI and the AP. The third car and the motorcade in Dallas. And Merriman Smith always knew, no matter what the weather, you keep the window down to hear what's going on. He heard the three shots, and he picked up the one phone. In those days, there were not cell phones. They had none, so forth. It was one phone. He always knew enough to sit in the front seat where the phone was. He grabbed the phone, called in a bulletin to Dallas that three shots had been fired at the president's limousine or the motorcade. And then from then on, he kept holding on to the phone and kept, he was a real talker. He could, you know, talk you, embroider any story, although he didn't quite know what was going on. As they were zooming toward Parkland Hospital, and the AP man was beating on him.
The AP man, it turns out, was a guy who covered Congress, and he was sent because it was a political campaign, and he really didn't know how this wire service stuff worked. So Merriman Smith held on to that phone forever.
Until they got to the hospital. And then he jumped out, and as he was running toward the hospital door, he saw Clint Hill, who was the first lady, Jackie's chief Secret Service agent, pounding on the limousine saying he's dead. So he called that in as a bulletin, of course, and we put it on the wire, but it was not official at that time. And each reporters who were in the motorcade ran and grabbed phones from nurses and so forth, started dictating everything they could. And the death of Kennedy was not announced for about an hour or two later. But Smitty knew that you always move with the whole entourage. And even if you're in the middle of your story, you drop the phone and go with them. And of course, he left with them, and he saw the got on the Air Force One and watched the swearing in and everything. So
and AP's fiasco
he
was
won the Pulitzer Prize and then
this new man who had not covered so much was in the phone booth dictating, and when the travel guy from the White House, Ray Zook, came by knocking on everybody's window say the president's going back, he didn't know who this guy was knocking on his window. So he kept dictating and he missed the plane back.
Oh,
we were in very deep trouble on the coverage of the assassination. You know where Helen and I were? Helen and I were taking to lunch one of Mrs. Kennedy's staffers in Paul Young's restaurant in downtown Washington. And somebody had a radio next door, you know, in the place, and all of a sudden we heard this. So the two of us jumped up.
I said, well, it isn't Saturday football, it's Friday. So I went over and I said, something going on. The president's been shot. We shot out of that.
She went to her office. I went to mine. We left this woman with the check. To this day, we know her.
And from then on, we covered 4 days of the funeral. Mm-hmm. And nobody slept. You know, you didn't want to. Mm-hmm.
It was very tough.
We were there when they brought the body back at 3 o'clock in the morning. The chief of protocol was waiting for Mrs. Kennedy when she walked up the steps of the North Portico, and he said, Mrs. Kennedy, is there anything I can do for you? And she said, yes, find out how Lincoln was buried.
Mm-hmm. He held the whole thing. He
had a great sense of history. Mm-hmm. Everything was planned, and it was, you know, remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Was there a difficulty getting information?
No. And afterward?
After the assassination.
Not really. Uh-huh.
People were very emotional. The mm-hmm. stories were mixed, everything. So people talked more.
Mm-hmm. And there was.
And it was, they really wanted this out. It wasn't something that anybody wanted to keep to themselves. I mean, the whole story of the funeral arrangements.
Yeah, we started covering with what's incredible about a democracy was the smooth transition to the next president. And it was almost automatic. And of course, LBJ had been training for that all of his life. Mm-hmm. And so he just took over.
And we were camped out at LBJ's Spring Valley house, telephones under the trees. And, so, you know, he went from one.
So he actually didn't move into the White House immediately.
Right.
Yeah.
Do we have a question here?
He's been trying a long time.
Okay.
You.
Me. Well, my question is, sir, I wondered if you would put yourself in the place of the president. You make this case that there should be as much access and we should have as much information as possible. But supposing you were a first-term president, whose main goal was to be a second-term president, what instructions would you give to your people in terms of...
Whose main goal was what?
Re-election.
Whose main goal was re-election.
That's the problem.
No, but I mean, that is the truth, though. So what kind of a public relations and press office should they have? I mean, they're only... I mean, I have this feeling at the moment that they're so secretive that it's boomeranging on them, and they make wrong decisions that they're going to be hurt by. But should they be as...
I don't think they should be his flacks, frankly.
What do you think they should have?
I think there ought to be a strong separation between the people's business and his political ambitions.
Yeah. But that seems to be the real problem, that the first time you get into office, your aim is to get reelected. And so you're always trying to see how it's going to face out for, you know, what's going to play with the public. And I think that you have to separate it, and the business that you're really conducting, the presidential business, should be open. I mean, what your personal thing is, I think that you have to worry about that in another agenda. But when you're working on information, on legislation, on activities, I think that should all be open.
Don't you think that most presidents, as they've come in, have wanted to stay there?
Sure.
But
the agenda should not be that the the people's information should be stopped by that, and that everything should be spinned to make you look good. I mean, it's a very difficult situation, but I think that's why we're there, to try to push them to get out of that mode.
And they all fall in this syndrome that they're so beleaguered and the loneliest job in the world. We're trying to get them out of there.
Towson?
I have a question about working with the wire services. Could you talk a little bit about the difference between working with the wire services versus the TV networks or the New York Times? And that sort of thing.
He wanted to know about the difference of working for a wire service and working for a newspaper, such as the Times. So, Fran?
First of all, you have a deadline every minute. I mean, you can't sit around and wait to gather more information. You go into a press conference, you have to come out. In our days, when you didn't have television people, you know, and all this stuff, you would have to hit the phone and that was it. So you don't have time to work on your story, to to advance it, to get more information. You can do that maybe later, but at the instant, you're hitting the phone and running. And that's the biggest difference.
And at the at the FDR news conferences or Eisenhower, any of them, long for TV, Eisenhower had television on a delayed basis.
Yep, Kennedy was first television.
But before that, the wire service reporters would call in one bulletin after another, three bulletins. You know, first bulletin story, they would do it, and then the second, then the third, and then they'd go back and wrap up the stories.
Would they do that, say, with the Roosevelt press conference afterwards?
Yeah,
they did that, but
they didn't have any help. Like now, back in the bureau, your own bureau, they're taking it off television and they can put it on. You don't have to do anything but just sort of watch what's happening and maybe give some color into the story. But they can get it like that. But in our days, we were stuck with, and when you're out on the road, you have no help. You just have to run with the story and dictate it. We're always dictating as fast as we can anything that happens.
What would be an average length of a story? Like, say you were doing a story on a press conference, and the first bulletin that you would put out, how long would it be?
First bulletin is just a paragraph, but they're about 800 words is the most nowadays they would allow. It used to go on forever. For example, the unknown soldier, when the tomb of the unknown soldier, when they brought the first unknown soldier back. I mean, AP's story just went on and on and on. He just dictated constantly, and there was no end to the story. But nowadays, papers don't want all that much, and they don't even want to edit it, so they want your story to be maybe 400 words.
In one of the Roosevelt press conferences, it was during one of the, they were at sea, and it was during one of the trips abroad that he took to meet with foreign leaders. But the president asked Doug Cornell if it was true that he had, in the previous day, filed 15,000 words. And he said that it was.
Yeah.
Because the president knew that was really some historic
kind of
level.
He was a terrific dictator. He could do it just beautifully. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the most difficult. You have to be able to dictate a story, punctuation, everything, and as you go. And then, as you say, there's three bulletins that you're handling. You have to have an add to the first bulletin, add to the second. You have to keep this all in your head and on your notes. And it's very difficult. And New York Times, they've got all day to work on this story. Mm-hmm. And they can go check and information, try to find background from other people and all that. We had to have it all with us or it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. After the end of the war, Doug, AP, stood over a teletype machine, and by this time they had dispatches from London, Paris, Berlin, Tokyo, Washington, you name it. They had all these dispatches. He stood over the teletype, dictated the bulletin first, and then the editor came over, took one look, and said, "Let it roll." He started dictating for an hour and a half, the end of the war, World War II.
Question from here?
Yesterday we had treated with about an hour press conference, President. I'm interested in your opinion on only the effectiveness of that press conference, but also the performance of the president and the performance of Tim Russert as a journalist.
I'm going to pass on that.
I think that. Of course, it was not a press conference. It was a one-hour-long interview. I think that Tim Russert did a good job. I expected him to be more Uriah Heep. Going to the Oval Office, you are awed, you know. He's in charge, and it's very intimidating, actually. You think you should really bow and scrape a little bit more. But I thought he was on target, and he persisted, which was good. I thought the president looked uncomfortable at times. Certainly, he knew he was under the gun. He knew he was being tested on very tough questions in terms of the war, economy, his military record, and so forth. You could tell that he had been primed for answers. They obviously could tell what questions that were going to be asked. So he certainly survived it, but I don't think, I think it told us a lot. I think it was a very good thing in the sense of you got an idea of what was happening to the president.
In a way, you know, we now have many more ways to see a president. It used to be that you saw the president in a press conference, and that was it. Say Eisenhower had 193 press conferences. Bill Clinton had 193 press conferences, but if you add in his short question and answer sessions and his interviews, it comes out to be 1,600. And so we really see a president in a lot of different ways. And interviews seem to be one of the ways now that we dig down.
He's only had 11 in 3 years, which is really a long time between drinks.
But the thing is, if it's a one-on-one interview, it's not as good because the reporter is also unseen here and is intimidated in certain ways. Mm-hmm. So that when you're all in a big group and it's not that kind of thing, it's much better and easier. Mm-hmm. And there's interesting things is when the president has a VIP visitor in the Oval Office, they always allow the press to come in. And it used to be that you could ask a question. Then the way things happen is, then they said, only cameras can go in, no reporters. So the television people said, if our reporters don't go in, our cameras don't go in. So that at least puts some pressure. See, the effort is always, there's always these fights always for every infinitesimal thing. Then there's the question of whether once you're in there, you can ask a question. And you used to be able to ask a question or two.
Yeah.
Now they don't allow any questions, and they take a shot, the president says something, and the visiting dignitary smiles and says something, out, lights out. Mm-hmm. And so this is the way it keeps getting cut down.
Uh-huh. Reagan had top advisors. He had Jim Baker, Ed Meese, and so forth, who were really his top people, plus Michael Cheever. And when he first took over, he was very friendly to us at the photo ops. We would throw questions at him, and he was very affable. And his top aides would become apoplectic because they thought they were smarter than him, and they didn't like his answers. They taught him to say, when we go in for a photo op, this is not a press conference, but this is a photo op. Once we went in, I don't know what was happening. It was some crisis. Sam Donaldson and I started throwing questions at the president as if it was a press conference. And he said, President Reagan said, I can't answer that. We said, why not? He said, because they won't let me. These were his top aides. They won't let me. We said, but you're the president.
We have another question from Towson.
How would you comment
on the fact that many believe that the American press is significantly milder towards the administration and foreign press towards their governments. For example, at the beginning of the Iraq War, Tony Blair was treated significantly more harshly by the British press than President Bush by the American press.
She's asking about the difference between asking questions of the president. The U.S. press corps seems to be lighter on the president at the beginning of the Iraq War than was true in other nations, in particular Britain. There, Tony Blair got questioned in a very sharp manner.
Well, you bet. I mean, Blair has to face. Are we talking about contracts?
Yes.
Well, Blair has to face the House of Commons once a week and go mm-hmm. very hard. President doesn't even have to have a news conference. He sure isn't having because reporters aren't putting enough pressure on mm-hmm. to get those answers. I mean, there are so many questions about war mm-hmm. that are not being answered.
Do you think that the U.S. press is more deferential to its leaders than, say, is true in Canada, Britain, Germany?
No, I think it was tougher right after Watergate, but I think 9/11 subdued everyone, and they went into a real coma. Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Fran? Do you think there are differences?
I think they're tough here as well. I mean, in certain instances, it's not. But basically, they're asking the questions that need to be asked. Mm-hmm. The trouble is, we don't have enough press conferences. Mm-hmm. I mean, you would see it come out more and more if we had more of these press conferences. I don't. Is an interesting thing that maybe some other people ought to look into. That is the question of televising these things. I think that being on television, knowing that you're on television, is very restrictive to people, and that perhaps both on the part of the press corps asking the question and the president answering the question, and even in the press
briefing,
It's made a large difference in kind of information you get. Because, you know, it's going out there live everywhere. Maybe it doesn't go on the air, but like I see it every day in my office when they, you know, I know what's going on. Everybody can tune in on all the networks and so on. And in some way, it's intimidating. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that it's the greatest thing that's happened to us being on television. I have to tell you that.
Yes, and McCurry has talked about that, and of course, there's no way to revisit that decision once the briefing went on.
But they want the press to look like ogres, but asking me questions.
Well, that, you know, and sometimes during the press conferences, you know, when everyone was shouting, Mr. President," the public was complaining about how rude and awful the press was at the president. And so now we have the system where the president, they put, where are the names of who's everybody sitting where, and the president says, calling on whoever they want.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, they give him a list of who to call on. He won't call on me.
That's right, they put her in the back row.
Do we have another question here? A last question in California, but here we go.
I'm wondering, I have a question really as a consumer of news as much as anything, and it seems to me over the last perhaps 10 years or maybe a little bit more, that more and more public figures, not just in the White House, but even congressmen, whoever is on the news, have learned that they can simply ignore the question and say whatever they want. Journalists ask questions, the answers often bear no relation to the question. Is there something that journalists should be doing? Is it something that viewers should be doing to counteract that?
Well, I think it is a problem, but the thing is that's where the follow-up questions should come. I mean, if you are not getting an answer to the question, you should ask again. And I recall asking someone five times and was given the same root answer, and I said, well, I guess you're not going to answer that question. And he said, well, I did. So there is this question, if you want to stonewall, you can stonewall. But if anybody's watching, they can see that you're not answering the question. So I think, like in a press conference, it would be totally obvious if the president ducks a question that everyone will see. So in some sense, that is showing the inability of the person you're interviewing so it reverberates back. But it doesn't help you in getting information, but the only thing you can do is try again. But if they don't want to, they're not going to tell you anything.
Mm-hmm. Our recourse in the past has been to write about it, to say there's a blackout on the news here, and we put that much pressure on it, I mean, it's effective. Our editors always say, nobody cares about the problems of the press. Well, I found that's very different, because when the Clinton administration came in, George Stephanopoulos was head of communications, and he closed the door of the press secretary, said we couldn't go there. And I said, what do we need a press secretary then, if we can't go and talk to him? And they locked the door. But they made the mistake of having the briefings on television, and they were hearing me shouting, why? What, how dare you lock these doors? We've been going here since Eisenhower. So for 8 years later, I was still asked, can you go to the press secretary's office now? Well, they had to open up 1 week after we started shouting from coast to coast. You have to show them that you're not rolling over.
From the beginning of when we covered the White House, there was always an effort, well, you can't be in the receiving room, or you can't do this or that, and we would write these stories, and that was the point that our editors always said to us, we don't care what your troubles are, we don't want to write about the press vicissitudes, and we would say, look, this is them cutting us out. And every time we wrote about it and paid attention to it, the situation would get cleared up. And it's absolutely true that you have to keep pointing out these little steps that they take to try to separate you from the information.
Mm-hmm. The problem is in these briefings now, none of the reporters support each other enough. Mm-hmm. You know, they should stay on subject and really help. And often they don't. They all come. Everyone comes in with their pet questions. So,
yeah, I was thinking about that in terms of an Eisenhower press conference where he had them every other week, and so they were a very regular item. In 1960, Sarah McClendon asked a question that she'd asked several weeks running, asking him what decisions Nixon had been involved in, and Eisenhower was irritated, and he said, only I make decisions, and that Nixon hadn't been involved in any decisions. And then Charlie Moore, who was then with Time Magazine, said, working off an earlier question, understanding that only you make decisions, what ideas has the vice president been involved in? And that's when President Eisenhower,
give me a week.
Yeah, give me a week and I'll try to think of something. And which was devastating, but that was one reporter working off another. That's right. Definitely going through press conferences. You can certainly see that change, and in part it probably comes about because they just they don't occur that often. And
there's another problem. Organizations send their reporters in to ask a question, and they only get one shot at it. And so they're only doing what the boss says to do, mm-hmm. so that it's not that old effort to follow up.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a